Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, hosted by Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kuhn. My guest in today's episode sheds some light on the difference between UX, user experience, CX, customer experience, and SX, service experience, and explains how AI is used in reality to cover not only those topics. In this context, we talk about how important it is, especially for UX leaders, to have a look on the complete system and not only concentrate on certain aspects of the user experience only. Therefore, a clear strategy and product vision is absolutely key to be successful in a UX leadership role. And best case, the product vision is also aligned with other stakeholders and, of course, the business purpose of the company. That's why my guest emphasizes the value of his MBA, which allows him to put himself in the shoes of sales and marketing guys and discuss business-related topics with internal and external stakeholders on eye level. Still, many designers are getting nervous about KPIs and data, but in the end, those hard facts can actually prove the value add they bring to the projects. Last but not least, we talk about how AI can actually be used to leverage design work to the next level, including some research results. So please check out this episode's show note for a link to a research paper on that topic. And of course, we share inevitable insights for aspiring UX managers. Now, enjoy listening to this episode, and as always, I'd really love to hear back from you. So don't hesitate to contact us on LinkedIn if you have further questions, comments, ideas for upcoming topics, or just want to say hello. Welcome to Lead UX, another episode of your compass for navigating the ever-evolving landscape of UX maturity in organizations and user experience team leadership. My guest today is Bas Berkut. He is Design Director at Chemistry. Chemistry is a strategic experience design consultancy, which is based in Singapore and Amsterdam. Hello, Bas. Great to have you on the show.
Hello, Thomas. Thank you very, very much. Lovely to be here. And thank you very much for the invitation. Hope to share some insights this evening on the topic of UX and, as you mentioned, the changing landscape.
Yes, for sure. So first of all, if you'd like to briefly introduce yourself maybe to our listeners, your bit of your background and your current job role, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so my name is Bas, short for Sebastian, living in the Netherlands, working for a Singapore company, and Chemistry is named Chemistry because we are always thinking about how to create the optimal interaction between the surface and a user, and that's about attraction. Yeah? So that's the English word for Chemistry. I've joined 3 years ago. Before that, I worked as a design director for a large design company also in the Netherlands with a more product design background. And before that, I worked at a production company. So my background is quite broad, so to speak. And since I've been working for Chemistry, I'm really focused on service design, as we call it, or experience design. But we will come to speak to that later on in the show, I hope.
Yes, definitely. So just for my or the listeners' understanding, mm-hmm. you have a background then in digital and analog product design, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm trained as a product designer, but that was before product design was also adopted as a name for digital products. So physical 3D design. That later, of course, evolved to what we now call product, which can be either digital or physical or spatial, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you also mentioned service design as an important topic you work on with your company.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So service design is for us thinking about how to make everything run smoothly between, let's say, the surface and the user. So that means we do a lot of work for in the hospitality business, which obviously has a lot to do with service design, but also with big insurance companies, also a lot with the service design. But then let's say the emphasis are some other topics, financial industry. Actually, there's no industry, at least that's what we think, there's no industry where service design is not a topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So now, before we really dig into the details, let's start with some more personal questions. So, what I usually am interested in is getting to know a bit better what your motivations are in UX. So, what gets you up in the morning? What motivates you to work in the UX field?
Yeah. Interesting question. Why do you get up in the morning, or what motivates you? And I always say that a good user experience, because that's what we're talking about tonight, that energizes me. So me, myself, but also the people around me. And if I can clarify that a bit, is what I like to do is remove friction. And that is a personal character trait that since I've, well, not since I've been born, but from young age, that's what who I am, you know? So that's how I'm wired. So for me, working in UX is some kind of an extension of who I am, to be honest. Removing friction, or trying to remove friction between an organization or a company offering a certain service, can be digital, but it's not necessarily only digital, and their customers. So yeah, it's an extension of me being me, so to speak, and doing the business. So yeah, that's really easy to get up for right in the morning.
Mm, yeah, definitely. So this resonates with me. I'm fully with you. So personal experience, maybe also with bad product or service design, is also something then in my case which motivates me to work in the industry and improve experience for our customers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So do you have a personal highlight, or maybe also a low light, so to speak, which you came across just recently to illustrate?
That's a good question. It's always what I always say is that good UX, good user experience, most of the time is intangible, or to be more precise, it's just there. You know, good user experience, like an invisible aid or a helping hand, you know, so... it's much easier to find, let's say, downlights or a not so highlight. So I have a good example. I think it tells in a nutshell where I think creating good UX often fails, despite good intentions. Let me emphasize that. And of course, what I just also said, that we do a lot in hospitality. So an area where UX is at the core, hospitality. We went on a holiday this summer in Sweden, a very nice country, by the way. And we stayed over in Hamburg, because from the Netherlands to Sweden, that's quite a drive. So we decided to go over and stay over in Hamburg. So finding a hotel, good hotel, was easy, you know, not a problem at all. Also, the booking with a hotel of our choice, no problem at all. Reservation, credit card details, confirmation, it all worked like a charm. So far is the good thing, you would say. And this hotel specifically demanded online booking and online payment. So that, according to them, that would save us time in the hotel, because we could get a code and then go straight to a room. So we thought, well, okay, let's do that. So when we arrived at the hotel, or rather arrived at the queue outside the hotel, which was a massive queue, it turned out that we had to change our codes to temporary card keys. But that had to be done at four terminals, non-human terminals. So you know, these vending machine-like things. Two of them didn't work. And because of the large demand, the other two also broke down and started to restart and reboot over again. So long story short, we had to turn to the service desk and check in manually with a real person. But she was not trained to do that. That's none of her fault, because she was just there doing other things. And she did try to help us as good as she could. But finally, it took us like 1.5 hours to get to our rooms after a trip of, I think, 5 hours in the car. So you can imagine we were not really happy. And what I thought, being a designer, I was looking at us. Yeah, it's a very good example of really good intentions. Okay, how can we make, you know, the check-in experience much easier and better and quicker, etc., etc.? But very poorly thought through, not tested at all, and very poorly executed. So yeah, I think that's a very good example of a downlight. In this case.
Yeah. This reminds me also of some experiences I had with self-checkout desks in supermarkets. If they work, that's fine. So as you said, you do not really realize that everything works smoothly, so you just pass through. But if they don't, then the trouble starts.
Yeah, and it's often the reason why this is done is often, let's say, comes from a cost-saving perspective. For instance, in this case, I know the hotel chain, so it comes from a cost-saving perspective. And I have all kinds of ideas about that, but okay, it's a cost-saving perspective. But then once you kind of set it up like this, then the costs of all these people standing outside the hotel, I will not return to this hotel anymore, because it's a stupid system. So it doesn't help me to. So the idea was, okay, we're going to save costs. We put in the machine. And as I said, poorly thought through and poorly executed. And then I think you're really, really missing the point of creating an optimal surface experience or optimal user experience. So,
Yeah, definitely. So, and a lot of burden is put on the user. And in the end, result is you will never go there. So they lost not only you, probably also other customers.
And
nothing.
Yeah. I'm, let's say, if you talk about the, you know, an NPS score or whatever, I will not recommend this hotel to another traveler. So I have friends and they also like to go, you know, and they visit the Hamburg every once in a while. So I will say, no, just pick another hotel. And that can't be the objective of this, let's say, of this way of setting up the user experience. So I think our job as a UX designer is to think about the complete system. So, okay, there might be a cost-saving aspect, but what does it do in the rest of the system? What does it, how does it lead to, so how are people going to react? What do they think? How are they going to behave? And only if you go through the complete system, then you will be able to say, okay, this is going to work or this is not going to work. So, and I think that's what often lacks, because in this case, the idea comes from the IT department or from the general management, and no other departments are consulted. So, but that's, we can dive a bit deeper into that aspect a bit later.
As this podcast is also about leadership, so I would change gear a bit more towards your leadership role you have in your current company. So talking about leadership and team leading, and also maybe instructing the folks who would create an experience in for such a kiosk, maybe. So what do you think? What makes a good UX leader? So what, which competencies are important in your daily business?
Yeah, I think not only for a UX leader, but I think a good UX leader, or maybe a leader at all, should be have a combination of empathy, strategic vision, and effective communication skills. So a leader is supposed to, you know, to inspire and empower teams, but that it can only happen in a collaborative environment, which will value feedback and innovation. So I would say, being a leader, then you have this clear UX strategy that aligns with business objectives on one hand and the user needs on the other hand. And I would say that's, let's say, for instance, the more the outward going, outward going aspects of being a leader. But inside the company, inside the organization, you have to listen to your team, you have to provide support, and you should take care that there are enough resources for your people so that they can grow. And you should be an advocate of user-centered design. So I think that's a combination of being a leader of problem solving on one hand and business speak on the other hand. That's, for instance, the reason why I did an MBA. So I have a design background, but I noticed that I was missing that necessary business speak, or I thought I was missing the necessary business speak to be able to cross over to the different departments in an organization. And only then, when I did that, then I started to be able to communicate effectively with stakeholders at all levels. So I think I would say that a good UX leader that is of course drives, you know, exceptional user experiences, but he or she also has to cultivate a motivated team, and that team must be equipped to tackle any challenges in creativity and collaboration. So I think, that kind of depicts what I would say a good UX leader should become.
Yeah, interesting that you highlight the necessity to also understand business context. That's also mm-hmm. something I realized. So when it comes to budget decisions and stakeholder management, this is really crucial to it's also sort of understanding our own customers as design leaders, our internal customers, true, which are, for example, business development guys or things like that. So would it be something you would recommend if our listeners, so some of them mm-hmm, are mm-hmm. about to make the next steps in the career ladder, is this something you would recommend? So maybe doing an MBA or at least getting some business knowledge.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. It really helps a lot. Nowadays there is a lot of talk about the in organizations about the you have these silos within companies, and you have the marketing department and the sales department and the operations department, etc., etc. We all know that we have to cross those silos. You know, you can only create this optimal user experience for your user if you work together, if you collaborate with the different people. So I do think that it's really helpful if you put yourself in the shoes of someone at the sales department or at the marketing department. And there is no better way than to do that than to get some kind of course or education in that sense. And an MBA covers quite a lot. From my personal experience, I got a lot to learn about the how marketing works, how sales work, how operations work, how the money side works, the accounting side works. So talking about cost effectiveness and these kind of things. So yes, I would definitely recommend to do something like that, because it opens up your horizon and makes you a better, I think it makes you a better designer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're on your way to, let's say, becoming a team lead, UX team lead, or a director or whatever, it will make you, definitely will make you a better leader and a better director.
What I experienced then, still, when you know something about, let's say, the problems the different stakeholders have, still there are conflicting targets.
Yes.
So how do you manage this in real life? So yeah. Of course, I mean, from a UX perspective or designer perspective, yeah. we want to reach the best solution for our customers, but it costs money, this takes time, et cetera, et cetera. So others might want to ship the product earlier and stuff. So how do you deal with that in real life?
That's I think the multi-million dollar question, of course, because everybody is not only if you're working in UX, but also if you're working in another department, you're confronted with the same problem. You know how to, there are always conflicting goals. So I think there are a couple of ways of tackling that. Just my two cents. I mean, it's not the it's based on my experience, not so much on scientific research, although there is scientific research, but I'm basing this on my own experience. So I would always start, what I'm always trying to achieve also in discussions with organizations is you have to start with establishing clear goals and roles. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. So delineate roles and responsibilities. Who is going to do what? You're from the sales department. Okay, what are you going to do? You're from the marketing. What is your role? What's your responsibility? Only then you can understand, okay, this is my role as a UX, part of the UX team or UX designer. That means you have to be able to openly communicate. You know, so you have to create that atmosphere where there is transparency and no one has a hidden agenda. So that's I think the second important part, which is open communication, and that only works if you know there are common objectives. So that means you have to create that kind of sense of unity, discussing what. If you have these clear goals, so what's the most important one? Where should we work on first in order to create that? So if you talk about, you know, if you would ask, okay, common objectives, how come? What's that? What do you mean? For instance, those should be objectives really tangible and really measurable. It's not like a common objective is like, okay, we would like to have more open conversations. Yeah, very nice, but that's nice, but it doesn't help you. No, it's a common objective might be we want to improve user satisfaction by, what is it, 20%. I'm just saying something like that. By only saying that, you're saying to the UX design, okay, how am I, that means I have to understand user satisfaction, so I have to do user research, usability testing, etc., etc. But the marketing has to start communicating these improvements and gather user testimonials. Sales has to get input from their customers, you know? So there's already a collaboration starting around that shared objective. The same goes for new product features. So, of course, UX design, you know, we're going to design the best interface ever. You know, this is going to be the best product that's ever been there. But, of course, the developers have to build and test it. So there's already two people in the collaboration. The marketing has to think about, okay, now how are we going to launch it? What are the benefits of these kind of things? Sales has to be trained, you know? So there are these, you see that there is no misunderstanding about the objective, and everybody knows the role they will have. So everybody can attribute to the success of the whatever they of the goal. And of course, once you are able to contribute as a person to a success of a goal, to get to the goal, then you are on your way to, let's say, resolve conflicting issues.
To my experience, the issue with design and also user experience related topics is that very often it's kind of vague. So when you talk to business people, I think mm-hmm. it helps a lot if you can attach some numbers to whatever the outcome Absolutely. Has to be. So as you mentioned, user satisfaction, and so how would you convince then or prove someone that your goals can be reached? I would say, of course, by attaching numbers to it.
Yes, it's. I think you have a very good point there. A lot of times, the discussion or the conversation is revolving around, okay, but what's actually the value you guys are bringing? You know, it's we're an external design agency, so of course we have to sell ourselves. So that's often the question. Okay, so what's the value you're getting here? You cost a lot of money, but it doesn't matter if we're an external design agency. The same goes for, we know from internal design departments, UX design departments, from we're working together with a big insurance company. They have a brilliant internal design department. They face the same problem. What's actually the value you are bringing? And you can start by telling, okay, but as UX designers, we understand the users and we do user research, and we go beyond the quantitative research and go into the qualitative research. We understand the why. It's all good, but you know, the other departments are only starting to react once you say, okay, but because of what we are doing together with you, we will be able to retain more customers. We will be able to lower the churn rate. We will be able to, et cetera, et cetera. So as you just said correctly, by adding those KPIs, that's then you finally have something objective to work from. And for designers, that's, I think, it's a bit scary, because if you look at how they are educated in school, it's a lot is about the technical aspects of designing, the creative aspects of designing, let's say the artistic side, you know, creating beautiful, engaging eye candy, so to speak. But what's missing in a lot of design education is that, okay, KPI, the measurements, how are we actually turn what we are doing into a value? How can we measure what we are doing? So yeah, that's a very important part of I would say being a UX designer.
Mm. You mentioned external agencies versus internal design mm-hmm. teams. So also something I wonder is, as a UX leader inside a company, would you rather, or do you work more on really product development, or do you rather focus more on developing the organization to the next level of UX maturity, whatever that is? But so how do you what do you focus on in that respect?
Yeah, I would say you have to do both, to be quite honest. I mean, it's if you look at the discussion in the work field nowadays, it tends to, let's say, lean a bit more to the organizational part, but you have to do both. So I would say by focusing on organizational development as a UX leader, then you can have strategic impact, because then you are the one who is, let's say, crossing the silos, crossing the bridges to the silos, trying to kickstart the cross-functional collaboration, and also working on a long-term vision. So that's kind of the basis it's almost like being a farmer, you know, you have to create the soil before you're able to create the create something which blossoms, in this case the UX design. So that means, but in order to be, let's say, to be believed, or to be to be a role model, you have to also have hands-on experience. So you have to keep practicing your design, let's say your design education or your UX design things, and you have to demonstrate your expertise. So I think by balancing those two things, then you will be able to kind of one and be kind of a mentor and delegate, because you're an UX leader, so you have to delegate the things, but you're mentoring the team members, and you will be able to position yourself and your team as being a strategic part of the product development.
Yeah, so it's a multi-step approach in the end. So prove your contribution, and then also that the organization is willing to listen in the end.
Yeah, and I think it's you have to kind of integrate that UX thinking into other teams, and you can say, okay, you know, you should do that, yeah, but you have to show how it can work then. So as I just mentioned, to overcome the conflicts earlier in the conversation, that's what you are doing as a UX leader. You're trying to overcome those conflicts by showing, okay, if you take UX as a starting point, it will help you in, for instance, doing your marketing job better. It will help you doing your sales job better. But then, getting back to your remark with regarding the measurement and the let's say the facts and figures, you have to be able to put facts and numbers to it. So, but it for me, it all starts with it starts with UX. It starts with the user.
Mm-hmm. And so, for the projects you work on, are you mainly consulting for product development, or do you also have like projects where companies deliberately ask you to leverage them to another UX level?
Absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So for instance, for this insurance company, we are doing this leadership training, and that's really focused on, well, as the name mentions, leadership for the team members, but also leaders from other parts, departments of the company. So that we're trying to kind of connect those together, and that's purely organizational development, but then riding on what you can do with user experience design.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's change gear maybe again and talk about another topic, which I definitely want to cover as well, which is service design, customer experience, and user experience. So those are terms that are used quite frequently, and also for some they seem interchangeable, but what's your take on the differences between CX, UX, service design, things like that?
Yeah, it's a wild west out there. No, but it's true. It's used completely in it's mixed, and what we always say is that for us, CX, or customer experience, is about the whole experience. So it's interacting with the company. So to give you an analogy, if you, for instance, every time you interact with a restaurant, from booking to leaving, so that's the complete, let's say, the complete world, so to speak. The service design part is about making sure that everything works smoothly in the background. So, for instance, how the restaurant organizes the kitchen, how the staff makes sure your meal arrives quickly, etc., etc. And then if you talk about the UX, the user experience, then we're talking about how good or how bad it feels to interact with a specific part of the service. For instance, how easy is it to use the restaurant's website? How easy is it to read the menu? How easy is it to use a table? So you see, it goes from, let's say, the general system approach, being CX, to the more detailed parts of it, which will be the user experience.
So do you see it like sort of as a pyramid? So the base layer is like the service design, and then maybe UX, your user experience, is the next layer, and on top, what forms then the complete system, so to speak, is the customer experience in the end, maybe something
yeah,
like that?
I would say that. And service design really dives into the details. But it's also about what we call orchestration of the several different steps.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of, you could say that service design kind of connects customer experience to the user experience. You know, so mm-hmm. those are like, and service design is in between, kind of orchestrating. Okay, we need specific parts on the website, on the app, on the whatever, on how I'm approached, whatever. And on the other end, so that's UX, and then on the other end we have the CX, because we have to look at the complete experience from the complete, for instance, omnichannel experience.
Yeah, so coming back to your example in the beginning, mm-hmm. so which part was missing there?
The part that was missing there was actually it was two things were missing there. The service design part was missing there because they didn't give any thought to okay, how is this onboarding going to work? And then the actual user experience in terms of this dreadful terminal with a very bad display and that thing keeping on restarting, that was also a bad UX. So bad service design, bad user experience.
Yeah, and if they would have thought about the service design part, then maybe they would have had at least one person who is trained to onboard.
Then they would have then at least they would have thought about, okay, how are we going to onboard these people? Okay, let us just do this, you know, let's test this, just play that you are a guest of the hotel and just book a room and just come to the hotel, and then, you know, and that was definitely not what happened. So yeah, that's often but unfortunately, we see that often a lot, that the testing part is kind of cut out from the creating part, so to speak.
So when we think of improving all those topics, mm-hmm. Of course, there is also a certain wave of applying artificial intelligence to this and that topic. So what is your stake on the AI wave, let's say? Would any kind of artificial intelligence could have helped in that situation? Or how do you apply AI in your projects?
I think it might or might not have helped in that situation. What you see these days is that, for instance, AI is now being the bot that answers your service questions, for instance. But still, it's not really conversational yet. That will come. But we think you can better put AI at a let's say a better place, which is we think it should be part of the creative process. So when thinking about creating a new UX opportunity or a new service design opportunity, that's where AI can play a very important role. Because so we look at it as being a tool to be used in that creative development, but because what it can do is it can make sense of a lot of data much quicker than we can, and it can help you to uncover any latent opportunities that they're not so obvious at first sight. So that's let's say the creating part of the service design, the creating part of the UX design. That's where we see AI definitely play a role. It already plays a role, but the role will become bigger and bigger. And not so much in, let's say, replacing human beings as it is. Well, a lot of people think it will replace, you know, the desk attendee or the person at the telephone. I'm not so sure. It's also there, it will be helpful. So to give you an example, we're working for a project for a large airport, and there we have this kind of staged approach. So when people come to the airport and they have problems with finding the way, for instance, because it's a huge airport, you could argue you should improve the signage. That's another topic, but so they can go to a terminal and they can ask for for the things they are looking for. That's AI supported in a way, not really intelligent, but okay, it, you know, the basic things you can ask. And if that terminal still isn't able to answer it, you can connect through the terminal to a real life person. So that kind of, you know, you have the AI take care of the most common questions and the most, let's say, you're not allowed to say stupid, but it's, let's say, the questions that come back a lot, of which you think, okay, you might have thought of it yourself. And then you use the human being for the intelligent work. And I think that's where AI is very, very helpful.
And in that case, it also is sort of a relief for the employee, because he or she does not have to answer the same questions every day. So this, as you said, stupid things, the easy ones can be handled by technology. And then when human creativity is needed, then this comes into play. So it goes hand in hand.
Yeah. And I think now you mentioned human creativity. There is a research, scientific research from the Base Business School and the Radboud University, which is a university in the Netherlands. They did a very interesting research on the role of AI in a creative process. And what they tested was to see, okay, we have, you know, a regular group of people doing a regular brainstorm on a service design topic. We have another group working with AI, and there is a complete AI generated group, which is actually not a group, but okay, let's say and it turned out that the most creative ideas came from the mixed group. So the people were literally, their creativity was augmented by using the AI, because it saved them time. It cut out, pathways that were already explored some time ago, which were you know, the very useless, these kind of things, you know. So it's, I think AI can help to augment these processes, and we definitely see it in also in service design and in user experience design.
Yeah, it would be great to link the document or the research paper in the show notes. Yeah, then. So
absolutely.
Maybe,
yeah,
we should do that, and it's interesting research. Absolutely. And I definitely, I mean, it's absolutely clear that the combination makes the best results, because in the end, any AI tool only can rely on historic data or on the training data, and this is always something which was already in the world. So
And as we all know, it helps if you're inspired by other samples and of what is out there. And I think the beauty of AI is that it can get that for you within seconds. Because if you have to do research yourself, you will have to plow through thousands and thousands of documents. So that makes it much more accessible.
There are also like tools out there where you can create like artificial personas or artificial users and then chat with those pretend you would do some research. Or do you have any thoughts on those tools?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. So I started by saying that we think that, let's say, you always have to start with the user, in mind. And having said that, that means we're talking about real users. And real users, in a way of being, let's say, the real human beings will be able to tell you why they are doing things. So if you are working with artificial personas, yes, they will be able to have this semi-real conversation, but they will borrow their ideas and their reactions from what is out there. And that's something that someone else said, or a group of someone else's said. So it kind of mimics personas, it kind of mimics people, but those are not real people. And I think you should always start with the real people, because you're only from let's say understanding and immerse yourself in a user group, talking to people, seeing how they react, that will give you much more valuable information. So yes, we also use that in our artificial personas, but then only to kind of get us up to speed. Say, okay, this is interesting. We can ask those kind of questions, that kind of questions. We might have missed that one. Okay, this is what it's like a training, and then we get this, and then we take it, and then we take it into the real world.
Yeah. So, and so how do you tackle with the problem of confidentiality when you use AI tools? Like, you know, probably you would not like to put all your business data or personal data in.
No. So there are some tools which are, let's say, closed tools. Mm-hmm. So then you can upload only certain documents in an environment, and it's only it's a dedicated environment. The more general ones, you know, like ChatGPT and Gemini and Perplexity and all these kind of things, you know, they don't treat your information that confidential, so you have to be really careful about that. So then you can only keep it very general, which is another let's say downside of using AI for instance, for creating personas or user journeys of these kind of things, because it's only general available information.
Yeah, so generic. Yeah,
it stays generic, and for the special things, then you have to do it in person. And a project that we are doing right now for immigration service, we are not allowed to use AI at all. Because and even I know we're doing a project, but I'm not cleared, so I'm have no clue what the design team is doing, because there are only three people cleared, so they have all the security clearances, etc., etc. So in this in these cases, you can't rely on technology. You have to you have to in the end have to rely on the human being instead, which is a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So, yeah, you mentioned the team. So, coming back to this aspect of our chat here. So, team lead and attracting talents to the company. So, what when it comes to building a team, so what are your the major things you focus on if you want to build a certain team for a certain project? What are you focusing on during this team building process?
There are some, it depends a bit on the, of course, on the project, but mainly you can, generally speaking, there are some things that that we look out for also in when hiring people, but also when building, let's say, building a team. Of course, you have to have a what we call a diverse skill set. So that means the team must have specialists, but they should be complementary. You know, so the one does user research, the other interaction design, the other visual design, the other usability testing, etc., etc. You know, so we have this microsystem of different expertises working together. And we think it's very handy to have T-shaped professionals. So you have people with a deep expertise in one area, but I've just said you have complementary expertise, but they might have a broader expertise in the other areas. So what it does, it allows them to communicate easily with each other. So you respect the other because of his in-deep knowledge of user research, I'm just saying, but because the other one also knows a bit about interaction design, he understands you as the interaction designers. Yeah? So that's kind of it. It it kind of stimulates the open communication. Another important aspect in a UX team would be what I would say continuous learning. Like you've asked earlier about the if you are for instance are a UX designer or you are a junior manager, what should you do? An MBA? You should do an MBA, but you should also do other things. You should learn other things. And that's, I think, conferences, workshops, online courses, etc., etc. So that's part of the team. The team is the culture should be embedded in the team, leading to knowledge sharing. Because what you don't want is people going to workshops, keeping it for themselves. No, you have to stimulate that they share their ideas and share their knowledge and share their findings and their insights. That means you have in the team there should be cross-functional integration, which means trying to establish relationships with other departments, product management, engineering, marketing, well, etc., etc. Of course, the team, I think that's obvious, should have a user-centered mindset. I mean, that's if someone in the team doesn't have a user-centered mindset, then there's no role. Not in the UX team, but not in the sales team, not in the development team, not in the marketing team. But that's my personal opinion. Meaning that you have to cultivate the empathy thinking. So you have to be an empathic person. I would say another mindset would be try to go for the data-driven decision making. So yes, it's about the qualitative data, but it's about the quant data, and it's about the combination of those and turn value into facts and figures. What else? What's in a team? I would say for the team leader, of course, leadership and vision, because without vision, there's nothing. That means and trying to convey that vision in a mentoring way to the team team members, to the junior team members. And I would say if you want to build a strong UX team, you have to have the tools and the processes. There's no, sounds obvious, of course, but try to have a toolkit where you you know, have consistent processes for design, for prototyping, for testing. Make sure you have a design system, because also having a design system allows you to communicate that into the organization, but also shows the value of what you as a team are doing.
Yeah. So, yes, thanks for this super valuable insights. I mean, this was really more or less complete overview about requirements for UX teams. So, and before we close, I mean, we talked already about requirements or recommendations for folks who think about, taking their next career step and think about taking some team lead role and stuff. So what would be your, besides maybe understanding the business part of things, your most important recommendations for like junior managers or aspiring junior or aspiring managers in the UX field?
Yeah, I think what I would say is most important thing is learn and be curious. I can't put it any any more clear, because that's, I think, should be your basic your basic character trait, maybe, but also if you're not that kind of person, you should learn that to do that, because only then you're able to expand and be able to, as we discussed, you know, be able to become a leader of the team, be able to be a facilitator for the development of other team members, be able to reach out to other departments, etc., etc. You can't do that without learning. You can't do that without being curious. Okay, if I'm to start collaborating with the marketing department, how do these guys and girls work? You know, it's I want to know, because only if I know and if I know and I understand, then I will be able to act on that and position myself. So yeah, it's it might not be a very sexy advice, but it's, I think, yeah, learn and be curious. That's, I think, the basic rule, and always keep the human being in mind. That's the other one.
Yeah, full support from my side. Can definitely subscribe to that. And yeah, I mean, almost 1 hour already that we talked.
Yeah, so, it's really fast. It's like, yeah, I think with this topic, we can go on for hours. I mean, there's a lot to discuss, but we keep that for a later stage.
Yes,
for other discussions. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, have a follow up then.
Yeah,
definitely. So yeah, thanks a lot, really, for your awesome insights.
You're more than welcome. Happy to be
inspiring.
To be a bit of assistance, hopefully, and to be a bit of inspiration to the listeners. As I said, we'll share the link to the research document, and of course, through the podcast, people can always reach out to me. So there's no
problem. So we will share your LinkedIn profile in the show notes
as well. Yeah.
And if any listeners have some questions or feedback, feel free to contact both of us.
Absolutely, I'm more than welcome to. I do that. A lot of times, and it's really I like to do it. So don't feel embarrassed or whatever, or think you don't bother. No, I love to do those kind of things. So reach out.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much for your time. It was great talking to you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
See you next time, maybe.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.